been going on the website. Okay. So tonight we'll do an overview of Canto 9, chapters 1 to 8, which is the first section, which we'll be covering, of Canto 9. So this means the closed book exam will be next Monday, the 27th of April, at 7 o'clock in the theatre. What's happening? Is the lights working now?
Not yet.
Not working.
No, I don't
know. What?
Because
needs to be cleaned up. Okay, so hopefully it gets cleaned up by next week. Okay. Okay, so then the closed book exam will be next Monday night, 7 o'clock to 9 o'clock in the theatre. And your open book exams will be due by the 28th, which is the Tuesday. So next Monday or Tuesday, you have to give your open book assessments. If they're later than that, then you'll lose percentage, you'll lose marks. And the oral presentations need to be finished by next Monday, Tuesday also. So tonight, we'll go through the first eight chapters of Canto 9. So what is chapter 1 called?
King Sadyumna becomes a woman.
King?
Sadyumna becomes a woman.
Sadyumna. Okay. So King Sadyumna, he becomes a woman. So, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he points out in the very beginning of the canto that this canto is dealing, like all the cantos, with all the 10 subject matters of the Bhagavatam, which are mentioned in the second canto. There are 10 subject matters, but he specifically says we'll be hearing about Ishanukata. Ishanukata means topics about the Lord and about great personalities, great devotees of the Lord. And specifically he says these great devotees will be teaching us about bhakti, Shuddha Bhakti, or pure devotional service, about Vijnana, which means realization, and about Vairagya, about actual renunciation. So we'll be hearing about this in the lives of the great devotees that we'll be hearing about. Particularly in this section so far that we've covered, we've heard about the life of Maharaj Ambarish, who is an exalted devotee. So we hear about his bhakti, his renunciation, and his realizations. So, Krishna Chakravarti Thakur also points out that there are 24 chapters in the ninth canto. First 13 are dealing with the Surya Vamsh, or the lineage which is coming from the sun god. And then the final 11 chapters are dealing with the Chandra. Yeah, coming from the moon god, Soma, or Chandra. So, specifically, we're hearing, first of all, about the Surya Vamsh. No mucking around, just sit down, either come in, come out, or sit down. I have to concentrate, so I'm not going to have walking around. So, the Surya Vamsh, or the descendants which are coming from Surya Dev, that is leading to the appearance of Ramachandra. He will be spoken of soon in the next section. And Lord Ramachandra is coming in the Surya dynasty. And then the final 11 chapters that begins to speak about the lunar dynasty, or the descendants of the moon god, his lineage. And that specifically is leading to the 10th canto, in which we hear about the appearance of Lord Krishna, which is the actual topic of the Bhagavatam. The whole purpose of the Bhagavatam is to get to this, which we'll get to in the beginning of next year by Krishna's grace, is the appearance of Lord Krishna in this world. So all this narrative, because it says that a Purana, it must have a certain elements to make it qualified as a Purana, and one of the elements, it must cover the history of the universe, the genealogy. So you hear all the Puranas, there'll be some description of the dynasties, so we hear about the Manvantars and so forth. So it is necessary to make this a purana, because it is the Amal Purana, the Bhagavad Purana, is describing about the history of the universe, particularly in this canto. We're hearing about a lot of the lineages. Some of the chapters are virtually just descriptions of the dynasties. So this is all leading to the appearance of Lord Krishna, which is the actual purpose of the Bhagavatam, of this particular scripture, the Bhagavad Purana, the Srimad Bhagavatam. So, beginning in chapter 1, we hear that the Manvantaras are described. And this has been going on since Canto 3. We've been hearing since Swayambhuv Manu, which is right back in Canto 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 now. So we're hearing more about the Manus, about their descendants of their descendants, like that. So it's the history of the universe. It's a family tree, or a genealogical table, how we understand how the universe evolved. So we're going back, we're hearing about all the different dynasties, the kings, how everyone was related to each other, how it all came about. So this is the description which is given. And in the very beginning of the chapter, Parikshit Maharaj is told by Shukadeva Goswami about the Manu, who is Shraddha, and his descendants, how it's evolving. And then it goes back momentarily in about verses 10 and 11. He describes about the describes about the Vishnus themselves momentarily, just to make us remember where this all comes. So the Bhagavatam is giving us the description of how the entire creation takes place, going all the way back to the Lord himself, his expansions, how they expand, the Chaturvyuha, the second Chaturvyuha, the Adi Chaturvyuha, the second Chaturvyuha, the Narayan expansions, then the Vishnu expansions coming from the Narayan expansions, which come into this material world, and then how they evolve from the three Vishnus, Mahavishnu to Garbhadakshaya Vishnu to Chiradakshaya Vishnu, and how everything evolves in this world. So part of this is being described. So that then it leads to, from Garbhadakshaya Vishnu comes Brahma, from Brahma comes the Manvantars, from the Manvantars comes the dynasties, and that's how the universe is populated. And that's how we came about in these present material bodies. This is coming from... So the Bhagavatam is describing everything from a personalistic point of view, how the creation takes place. So it requires a great deal of Shraddha or faith, because no one in the material world possibly believes any of these things. But we wholeheartedly believe, because it's a description of our universe based on the authority of... ancient personalities within this universe, and ultimately coming from the Lord himself. So we hear that the Manu, described in the first chapter, he wanted a son, and because he did not have a son, then he performed a yajna. However, the wife wanted a daughter, so then she spoke to one of the priests, and the priest chanted certain mantras, and then a daughter was born. But he was unsatisfied. So being unsatisfied that he did not get a son, then Vasishtha, the great sage, the powerful sage, he transformed the daughter back into a son. So these very powerful living entities who can change the sex of the gender of a living being within this world. They can change the body. These are extreme powers which were there previously. So then it is described that the king, whose name was Sujumna, he then went into the forest, but then approached a place which belonged to Lord Shiva. And it said that anyone who entered into that place had to be feminine, because Shiva was the only Purush, she was the only enjoyer, the only male in that place. So as they entered into that particular forest, they were transforming into females. And then it was said to him that he would stay female 6 months and then male 6 months. Like that. So these are this particular canto is giving some very amazing kind of descriptions like that. 6 months male, 6 months female, and so many things are given in this canto, which are almost inexplicable like that. So, it is described that, or Prabhupada mentions, that one should not become caught up with the external bodily dress. Sometimes, people in this world, well, not sometimes, but practically everyone in this world these days is very much caught up with their external appearance and gender and identification according to the body. I am male, I am female. Prabhupada points out these things are not so important. Why? Because the body changes in a very short period of time. So we should not become so caught up or so preoccupied or identify so strongly with our external identification according to our material body. I am male, I am female. And these days, in Kali Yuga, it is not uncommon for people to change their sexes. And it's becoming more common, and it will become much more common. And I even know devotees who have done these things, who have changed their gender. And I know devotees who want to do it. But obviously it's difficult, because in our society it's obviously looked down upon, but you know, and there's a struggle within them, because they feel like they're in the wrong body, they have a different subtle body, they're in the female body, but they feel like they have the male subtle body, or vice versa, and then they want to change like that. So we can't judge devotees too heavily if they do these things or want to do these things, because it's very difficult, the conditioning is very heavy. But the ultimate lesson that the Bhagavad Gita is teaching us is these things are just external. We should not judge devotees too carefully to actually do these things, because that may be very difficult for them because of their conditioning, but it's not actually, ultimately it's not important. We shouldn't judge so heavily, because if we're in that situation, we don't know what we would do. You would probably change into so many different things. These are just external situations. So then the second chapter is called
The Dynasties of the Sons of Manu.
The Dynasties of the Sons of Manu. Okay, so more genealogical explanations of how it all evolves. So we're hearing about the dynasty of Vaivaswata Manu, who is another Manu. We've heard about Swayambhu, and then in the previous canto it described the remaining Manus, and now Vaivaswata Manu in particular. So then it tells about one particular king, whose name was Prishadra. Yeah, this is in the second chapter. So who can tell me something about Prishadra? Anyone? Someone? Okay. Someone working.
He was renounced. He was renounced from the very beginning, and he left the kingdom.
Okay.
And his son was a missionary.
He killed a cow by mistake when he was guarding at night.
Yeah. Yeah. So he was following Dharma very carefully. So his dharma was to protect the cows at night. He took on that duty. And while protecting the cows at night, one tiger came and he attacked the tiger with the sword, but accidentally he took off the ear of the tiger, but he also killed the cow simultaneously. So he didn't realize until the morning time that he had killed the cow, and then he felt very repentant naturally because he was a great devotee. But his guru was very upset with him. What was his guru's name?
Vashishta.
So Vashishta Muni is not completely transcendental to the modes of material nature. And someone who is not transcendental to the modes of material nature, he may become very angry very easily. And we said last night, which mode of material nature is anger connected with? Mode of ignorance, come with me. So one is becoming angry too much. We all become angry, but if you're too much controlled by anger, this means you are tamasic. This is tamagun. So he was controlled by tamagun to a great degree, and he became angry. And then he cursed Prishadra. So this is completely unnecessary. So Prabhupada points out we have to choose our guru very carefully. Because there's a very sentimental system, particularly in the Indian system, about gurus. This is my family guru and like this. But you have to see the adhikara, the qualification of the guru. The guru must be a Vaishnava. as opposed to a Brahmana. Because we see in this canto several times, there is Devasa Muni, right? There is Vashishtha Muni, and each one of them is committing mistakes. Why? Because they're affected by the moments of material nature. So even though they may be taking birth as Brahmanas, they're not transcendental. And specifically, if we choose a guru, the guru must be transcendental. He may not be completely free from the effects of the modes of nature, but he must be a bhakta, he must be a devotee. Only a Vaishnava can be qualified as a spiritual master. So Vashishtha, he became angry and he cursed Prashitwa. So, what took place after he cursed him?
He accepted with humility, of course. He didn't try to.
That's a very important point, that he accepted his destiny. And we've covered this many times in the Bhagavad Gita, that we must accept our destiny. We must not always try to oppose or override or change our destiny, because there is only so much you can do in this world. What you're destined to suffer and enjoy in this world is predestined to a great degree. So therefore, a devotee, naturally, he accepts the negative things and the positive things which take place in our life. So, what happens after that?
And because of his devotion and service, he gets purified and he gets
the curse. Yeah, so he accepts the curse, he purifies himself, right? He takes vows of brahmacharya, he fully absorbs himself in devotional service. And then one day he walks into a forest, and what takes place when he walks into the forest?
Fire.
He sees a forest fire, right? And instead of trying to escape the forest fire, right, and become materially absorbed in protecting his body, he sees it as an opportunity to transcend this world. And he allows the fire to burn his form. So we see Vritasura. In the previous canto, canto 6, right, we see the pastime where he also accepted his destiny. Dadichi, we saw in canto 6, accepted his destiny. So in this way, these great personalities, being above and beyond their attachment to the material form, they transcend. So he allowed himself to transcend. What takes place after this? And it also describes that some of the Kshatriyas, they became Brahmanas, like that. So Prabhupada emphasizes, as he always does at these points, that you cannot judge someone simply by Janma, but someone must be understood by their guna and their karma. By their activities and their qualities. Then we understand. So many of these Kshatriyas, they became Brahmanas. It mentions specifically three of them became Brahminical. Being Brahminical, they practice on the Brahminical platform. In other words, they develop detachment from this material world, which is what the Bhagavad Gita is ultimately teaching us to do. Prabhupada said, ISKCON must create a class of Brahmanas, people who are spiritually advanced and materially detached from this world. Okay, what is chapter 3 called?
The marriage of Sukanya and Chavanamuni.
Yeah, so the marriage of Sukanya and?
Chavanamuni.
Chavanamuni, yeah. So another very interesting pastime. The ninth canto has many very interesting pastimes, which are very, how would you say it? They're very,
instructive.
Instructive, yeah. Mysterious. They're very unconventional, very extraordinary. I mean, these pastimes are very, just trying to think of the right word. What's that?
Supra mundane.
Yeah, super mundane. But they're more like, they're very, I'm just trying to think of the right word.
Uncommon.
What is it?
Uncommon.
Yeah, very uncommon. Like very uncommon, unconventional pastimes. Where with Charita, you know, Sukanya, the young girl, she's the princess, enters the forest with her friends, and then sees within the hole two glowing eyes, So she takes a stick and then, like a little girl would, you put something in the eye and then suddenly blood starts coming out. Right? This worm, and then the worm becomes a sage. I mean, the ninth canto is very unconventional. I mean, what takes place is just extraordinary. You know, we have kings turning into women, right? And then they're women 6 months, and then they're men 6 months. Right? Then we have sages being stuck in the eyes. And this is only like chapter 3. Everything's like very unconventional. So many of the pastimes in this particular canto, they're very extraordinary kind of pastimes. So Chavana, he comes out, he's been stuck in the eye by his future wife. That's a good way to start the relationship. And the father is very he's very nervous because the sage has been hurt by the daughter, and then suddenly he becomes very fearful that an offense is going to be has been committed, and that he will get a reaction to the offense. So he becomes very disturbed, very conscientious. And basically, as devotees, I remember my spiritual master said this many years ago. I heard it when I was a new devotee. He said that it is very healthy for a devotee to be fearful of committing offenses. We should all be fearful about committing offenses, because it's so easy to offend other people. So a devotee should be very conscientious and very careful not to offend, not to commit aparads, Vaishnava aparads. So, being very careful and very fearful that he committed offense, then he followed the Vedic culture very carefully. He followed Grihastha Dharma very carefully, and he gave charity to a Brahmana. So this is the system, that you should always offer respect to the superior personality. So this Brahmana, this sage, he was an exalted personality. So naturally he wanted to pacify him, so he offered charity. Now, he offered his daughter in charity, which is a very precious gift, to give your daughter to someone. But he was obviously so fearful, because he had offended the sage, his daughter had offended, then he said, please, take my daughter. So, as we know, as the story goes,
he asked for the daughter.
Yeah, he asked for the daughter. Yeah. He said, give the daughter in charity, and then he gave.
Yeah, he said, is she married? And then he said, and then he tried what he wants.
Mm. Yeah, so he had a plan in his mind. So maybe he went down the hole, or maybe he took the form, had the glowing eyes, because maybe he was tree-colored gar, or maybe Krishna made him do it. Yeah. We will never know.
I think so.
You think Krishna made everyone do it?
They already got some reaction for that offense immediately. They all became constipated and people didn't pass urine also. So
all the soldiers and everyone became disturbed. So they understood some offense had been made. Like that, so.
What is Lord Krishna?
What? Yeah. Okay. So, she took on the responsibility of being the wife of a grumpy old man, which is a very difficult thing for a young woman. But this is Vedic culture. Vedic culture is so powerful that the wife will accept the frailties of the husband, and she will still treat the husband respectfully. Now, this is a very important thing, and this is being lost and misunderstood in modern times. That men are masculine, women are feminine. Right? And that will always be there. It doesn't mean a woman is not strong and responsible, but still she has a soft feminine nature. A man has a masculine nature, he has particular attributes, a woman has particular attributes, and we have to be conscious of these attributes even in the modern age. And quite often in this modern age, right, women are acting too masculine, and men may be too feminine even, you could say, and there is problems in the relationships. Whereas previously, and even in this day and age, it still holds true that if we follow the natural basic instincts, doesn't mean one has to be exploited or dominated, but if the feminine role is played properly and the masculine role is played properly, there'll be peace within the relationships, within the marriage. So this was the Vedic culture. They were trained like this. So even though she was married to someone who was older, who was unpleasant, She still performed her duty very properly, and she gained all auspiciousness. Now, Prabhupada makes a very important point, and there's a very important purport in that third chapter, where Prabhupada says that the woman gains victory over the man by serving him very nicely. She pacifies the mind, and the home will become peaceful. Yeah, the home becomes peaceful when the wife is proper in her conduct or her attitude towards the husband. And the husband has to be proper in his attitude and his conduct towards the wife also. But she very much creates the mood within the home. The responsibility very much lies with the wife. Prabhupada even says that if there is divorce, it is the wife's fault. He says that. And technically it's true, although that doesn't hold very well in the modern world. If you say this to the modern people, I think it's very sexist and very one-sided. But actually, technically it is true. That the wife, if she acts in a particular way, then the husband will be pacified and the home will be peaceful. So, he desires to have a young body. Because the whole nature of grihastha life is for enjoyment. It is a license for sense gratification. So he wants a young body. So when the Ashwini Kumaras come, then he asks them, please give me a young body. He asks for the benediction. And the Ashwini Kumaras, they grant that benediction. And she is so chaste that when the Ashwini Kumaras, when they approach Sukanya with Chavanamuni, and now he looks like an Ashwini Kumara, he looks like a demigod, very young and beautiful, she's confused as to which one is her husband. And once again, that the quality of a woman is chastity. That is one of the supreme qualities of womanhood. She must be chaste to her husband. So even though there's three attractive men there, she says, which one is my husband? Because psychologically, she will only serve and she will only be, she will only relate to her husband. She will not accept the others. So once again, it shows us the quality of proper conduct in married life. Then they impart Ayurveda, because they are the Ashwini Kumaras, that is their department of knowledge within the heavenly realm. And Prabhupada points out that they're practicing Ayurveda, and that gives us, Ayurveda gives us good health within this world. Because the body is a machine, it's a yantra, and it needs to be looked after properly so that we can serve Krishna effectively. And one thing we see devotees not doing is following basic health principles. What does Ayurveda basically tell us? Eat properly and do exercise. And what do we see devotees not doing? Not exercising and not eating properly. What is that? Yeah, Mahaprasadam's okay, but not all the time. Not only Mahaprasadam. Yeah, if that's all you're eating here, you're going to get sick, obviously. So, devotees need to learn these basic Ayurvedic principles. To eat properly, right, and to exercise regularly. And if you're not doing that, you're not being Krishna conscious. Because Prabhupada said health first, then Krishna consciousness. He said that. Right? And if you look at his letters, every single letter was signed, I hope this meets you in the best of health. Every letter, not thousands of letters. So it is not Maya to look after your health. It's actually your duty, it's your service to eat properly and to exercise regularly. And this will be one of the major questions on your exam. Are you eating properly and are you exercising regularly? And if you want to pass, if you want to get 5 marks, then you have to say what your exercise regime is and what your diet is. And which medicines you're taking. So, devotees have to take care of these things. But Prabhupada says the ultimate science and the ultimate solution to life's problems is the Srimad Bhagavatam. Ayurveda will only take you so far. We're not into Ayurveda in and of itself. We follow Ayurveda because it will help us to keep a healthy body so that then we can serve Krishna and we can realize Krishna. So we should be healthy, we should be strong, but only so we can realize Krishna. That's the goal of life, is the Bhagavatam itself. So, Prabhupada points out that the wife must be chaste, and ultimately she also should be a good cook. Prabhupada always emphasized these two things for a woman. She should be good cook and chaste, and then the husband will be satisfied, and he will always be happy, and then she will always be happy. Then, it is pointed out that when we choose our spouse, we should choose someone based upon their, we can ask, what is the most, we did mention this when the class was given for that third chapter, what is the most important factor when choosing a husband or a wife? Yeah, it is based on spiritual principles. Right? We choose a husband or wife based on their devotional merit, not the material qualification, but the spiritual qualification. That is why we look. Now, when we get married, we want to see, is this person a serious devotee? Are they sincere about Krishna consciousness? And if they are, then we will accept that husband or wife. Otherwise, we are not interested in something which is based on externals, simply material qualifications. So then, what takes place after this?
The father comes.
Yeah, the father comes and
chastises
her, and
Prabhupada says this is Vedic culture, that the father is teaching the proper conduct to the daughter.
Yep.
He doesn't encourage the daughter having somebody else with her, even though she has an old husband, he doesn't encourage that.
Yeah. And he emphasizes that by following Dharma, the path of Dharma, because she sticks to her Dharma, it creates auspiciousness within their lives. So everything becomes auspicious when you follow Dharma properly. Because one of the problems these days is people leave their wives, they leave their husbands, it becomes adharmic for no good reason, and then everything becomes inauspicious. But when you follow Dharma ideally, everything in your life will become auspicious, and then you'll be happy and peaceful in this world. So, any other points?
But she just smiled. She didn't get upset or anything.
Yeah.
Just smiled.
Yeah.
Because she was confident that she had done the right thing.
Yeah.
If you do the right thing, you don't have to be scared of anybody.
Yeah. Yeah, the wife should always smile all the time. That's one of the most important features. Any other
technical point that comes here towards doing this, you know, in the same lineage, then Balramji's wife is
coming.
Rakodni's wife.
Yeah. Yeah.
But no, not much explanation in
it. Yeah, because it's leading into the ninth, oh, sorry, the tenth canto. So it's just like a precursor or a beginning explanation of the appearance of Lord Balaram. Because it just mentions that the daughters were given to Balaram. Like that. So it's getting closer because we're almost there. So. Any other points? So chapter 4, what is chapter 4 called? Yeah, so this is an important chapter. Probably of the 8 chapters in this section, it's probably the most important chapter because there's many, many lessons. And the other chapters, there's not a lot of purport and the personalities are not so prominent, but Ambarish Maharaj is very famous and very prominent. In this particular chapter, there's many, many important instructions which are there. So probably in the exam, we will hone in on this chapter in particular. I mean, all the chapters will be covered, but this chapter is the most, out of this section, it's the most instructive for us in particular. So learn this chapter nicely. Nabhaga teaches us that we should be aware of cheating. He was the father of Ambarish. So he became a brahmachari. He left home. He went to perform devotional activities and austerities. Then he returned. And then his brothers had inherited the father's property. They divided everything up. They thought he wasn't coming back. They didn't leave him anything. And then when he got back, then he said, where is my share? They said, no, there is no share. I said, go to the father.
Father is your share.
Yeah, well, actually said, the father is the share. Right? So then he goes, the father says, no, this is not correct. this is not correct. But then the father instructs him. The father is very intelligent. He said, now you go and beg from these Brahmins. They're doing a sacrifice. They will give you the charity. That will be your share. So it is emphasized that we should not be cheated. And Prabhupada did not like this. He didn't like that we got cheated. Even when Prabhupada went to Vrindavan and Mayapur and those places, Prabhupada would argue with the rickshaw wallahs. Yeah. And when it was only back then, it was probably only over 1 or 2 rupees. But Prabhupada was very emphatic that devotees do not get cheated. In other words, we have to be streetwise. We have to be materially competent and smart. And Prabhupada was like that himself. He was very particular. He would not, and he would criticize his disciples. You read in the Lilamrita, when they're building the Krishna Balaram Mandir, and they're becoming ripped off by the local business people. You know, they're buying the sand and the cement and the supplies, and they were being overcharged. Now, because they're Western, they hadn't been to India before, they didn't know the prices, they don't know how India works. They were getting overcharged for everything, and Prabhupada came in, and when he found out what they were paying, he got so upset. He said, why are you letting them cheat you? Why are you letting them take Krishna's money unnecessarily? Because even if you, Harisori Prabhu, he mentions in his diary that Prabhupada and, what was his friend's name in Vrindavan? Was it Bhagavati?
Kinjinder Krishna.
No, not the Kinjinder, but there's that other elderly man. He would come and see Prabhupada every day, and he helped Prabhupada a lot in the management of the temple. I think it was Bhagavati, I think that was his name. So he would come, and they didn't have a lot of money back then to run the Krishna Balaram temple, and how much they were spending on the deity's bulga per month. When Prabhupada heard how much, he said, this is way too much for back then. I think it was 5,000 rupees a month was the budget, and that was back then, which was obviously a lot of money, and Prabhupada, this is much too much. So him and Bhagavati, they sat down for an hour or two, and they analyzed how much it would cost to make the puris, you know, how much the after flower would cost. They analyzed it. They analyzed every single item on the deity's offering. Then they gave the figure at the end. They said, this is how much you should be spending per month. And it was less than half of what they were actually spending. He said, you're just wasting Krishna's money. So Prabhupada did not appreciate that we waste Krishna's money. And we should understand that any money that we have is Krishna's money. It belongs to Krishna. So we don't have a right to waste any money. As grihasthas, you have responsibility. And sometimes I see grihasthas, you know, with all due respect, some grihasthas, I see them wasting money, buying this and buying that and doing this and doing that, but it's not necessary. In other words, the money should belong, it does belong to Krishna, it should be used wisely and properly. And as much as possible, then you donate it directly to Krishna conscious activities. So he goes, he receives the charity from the Brahmanas, and then after receiving the charity from the Brahmanas, one black figure approaches him and says, actually everything belongs to me. So he said, go to our father, we will sort this out, he will tell us who the money belongs to. And then he reveals to himself, this black person is Lord Shiva. And when he finds out that it's Lord Shiva, he says, okay, take everything. You know? So that is the proper attitude. And when Lord Shiva sees that he has given everything, which was his, to Lord Shiva, Lord Shiva says, you have passed the test, now you can keep it all. So basically, as Prabhupada is pointing out, we should follow our superiors under all circumstances. He followed his father, and then he followed his superior, who was Lord Shiva. And because he followed the superiors and he passed the test, he was blessed with all material facility. Lord Shiva gave everything back to him. Yeah, and it says that he gave knowledge too. Yeah. Spiritual knowledge. Okay. So Prabhupada, now the son of Nabaga, his name is Ambarish Maharaj. And this is a famous personality. Prabhupada often speaks of Ambarish Maharaj within the Bhagavatam. So, Prabhupada points out at the very beginning of the pastime that bhakti is more powerful and always remains victorious over karma, jnana, and yoga. So if one is a devotee, he is more powerful than a kami, more powerful than a jnani, and more powerful than a yogi. So therefore, a devotee has nothing to fear. And we see that in this pastime. So, the real wealth, Prabhupada points this out in one of the purports, real wealth in this material world, or in creation, or in existence, is bhakti, or prema, ultimately, love for Krishna. So if one has prema, one has love for Krishna, everything else becomes insignificant. Karma, jnana, yoga, they're insignificant. Bhukti, mukti, siddhi, kami, akale, ashanta, Krishna bhakta, nishkama, ata eva, shanta. So Krishna bhakta, that is real wealth. One who has bhakti for Krishna, prema for Krishna. But if you are bhukti, mukti, or siddhi, which means you are kami, jnani, or yogi, you will never be fully satisfied. This is not real wealth. Advancement, or real progress in life, or real achievement in life is having prema or love for Krishna. So, he followed his guru properly, and Prabhupada points this out. We hear about the famous verse from this section, which is the key memory verses, the KMVs for this section. What are the KMVs? It describes how Ambarish Maharaj engaged all of his senses and his mind and all of his material abilities in the service of Krishna. So it describes, ultimately, that everything stems, and Prabhupada points this out in the purport, devotional service, adol, guru, pada shreya. Devotional service begins with surrender to guru. Because we only learn how to use all of our senses and our mind in Krishna's service from the spiritual master. Without spiritual masters, or without divine instruction, we don't understand how to serve Krishna properly. So here it is being pointed, Prabhupada says from the very beginning, if we want to attain sajya, sajya means the goal of our sadhana. Because Ambarish Maharaj is showing us how to engage in sadhana bhakti, how to engage all of our senses in Krishna's service. So what is the goal of engaging all of our senses in Krishna's service? Practicing sadhana. Rupa Goswami says the goal of sadhana is sajya. Sajya means perfection. Perfection means bhava bhakti or prema bhakti. That is our goal. That is the prayojana. So how to attain that goal? Right? We learn to use all of our senses in Krishna's service, perform our sadhana under the guidance of our guru. And this is how we understand how to attain Krishna. So then, understanding all of this, he ruled the entire world properly, and he set a perfect example, and it mentions that all of his citizens were also fully engaged in devotional service. So he was an ideal king. He ruled everyone properly, set a proper example, inspired everyone so much, everyone else wanted to perform devotional service or bhakti also. So he's extremely powerful. So then, he provided for everyone, and it describes that he became incredibly renounced. His performance says, the Bhagavatam says, he's performing severe austerities. Fully engaging himself in Krishna's service, performing severe austerities. So then he went from the capital, Mathura, he went to one forest called Madhuvan. Madhuvan. It's in Vrindavan. Mathura.
Madhuvan. They call it as Mathura.
Mathura. Mathura is the city. Madhuvan is the forest. Yeah, it's outside of Mathura. So, Madhuvan, he went there, and it was in Kartik Mas. And it was on the Ekadashi in Kartik, extremely auspicious time. extremely auspicious place, just like today is called?
Akshay Tritiya.
Akshay Tritiya. Did you see the moon? No? Did you look outside before? You saw the moon? Where is the moon today?
Down. I saw the moon.
You saw
it? It's a little down.
Yeah, it's down, means it's low. But where is the moon?
I saw it. It was very low.
I know, it's just over there. I saw it as well. But where is it today? Which constellation? Which nakshatra? Which sign is it in? It's in Taurus. Mm-hmm. So the moon becomes exalted. It gets most powerful when it's in Taurus. And where is the sun today? In Aries, right? And the sun becomes most powerful when it's in Aries. So this is the one time of the year, this one day of the year, where both the sun and the moon are in its strongest position. That's why it's called Akshay Tritiya. Because it says that anything you do on this day, if you begin anything on this day, you get great blessings on this day. We actually got permission to do holy today.
Yeah.
Sri Titan and myself, we go through a lot to try to get this festival happening. So today we got blessings, and it's a very powerful day to begin something. Because you get, and it says that it's so auspicious today that even inauspicious or auspicious times, normally during the day, you have to look for the auspicious time to begin something. Since today is so auspicious, you don't even have to worry about the times. Because
Parashuram,
something connected with Lord Parashuram
for
the
Yes,
appearance. Did he appear today? Yes, appearance. His appearance. Yes, Parashuram appeared also. So yeah, it's very auspicious today. So this auspicious time was a Ekadashi in Kartik, which is extremely auspicious. And he's in the Holy Dham, in Vrindavan itself. Madhavan's one of the 12 forests. So he's performing, he's fully absorbed in bhakti and devotional service. He has become completely absorbed. We see from the previous verses, his mind, all of his senses, everything is fully absorbed in Krishna's service. And then at that time, when he's doing all of these things, specifically worshipping his deity, Devasa Muni comes. Now, Devasa Muni is the opposite of Ambarish Maharaj. Ambarish Maharaj is what we should be, and Devasa Muni is what we should not be. In Nectar of Devotion, Rupa Goswami points out that if you perform too much tapasya, your heart becomes hard. And what was the defect of Devasa? Yeah, his heart was hard because too much austerity. He was a great brahmana, extremely powerful, extremely sense controlled, right? Did great austerities, great tapasya, right? Was extreme, had a great amount of brahminical tejas, power, potency, but he was proud. And he's easily angered. When you become proud, you become, I'm superior to others. So he came to Ambarish Maharaj and he thought, Ambarish Maharaj is a grihastha. He is a kshatriya. He's of a lower position than me. But actually, Ambarish Maharaj was more exalted than Devasa. And that is what the Bhagavatam is pointing out to us. Now, if you look at the 12 Mahajanas, you'll see that most of them are grihasthas. Right? And many of them are kshatriyas also. So they're not, in terms of ashram, they're not the most on the highest level, but they're considered to be the greatest devotees. Right? Whereas Devasa Muni, he was a brahmana, but because he was not a devotee, right, he became proud of his situation. So he cursed Maharaj Ambarish. Now, first of all, he'd gone off to perform his ablutions. He came to see Maharaj Ambarish. And Maharaj Ambarish said, please, I will feed you. He said, I need to go and do my ablutions, go and bathe and perform my duties. So he went away. But then while he was away, the auspicious time to break the Ekadashi came. And Maharaj Ambarish, he consulted with the Brahmanas, what should I do? And what was he advised?
Drink water.
Actually, they were not
They did not give an answer. And then he decided, He said, actually, when he thought about it, and he remembered all the Shastra and the scriptures, there is one verse which says that if you drink water, you break the fast. If you don't drink, or if you drink water, you do not break the fast. So both ways it can be there. And Prabhupada said this, actually. Just like on Janmashtami, I do nirjal, right? No water, because that is the standard we're meant to follow. But if you do take water, you're also doing nirjal technically. You're not breaking the fast. Yeah, I mean, you're taking jal, but the fast is not broken. So it is said that if you take the water or don't take, then still you're considered fasting. Like that. And Prabhupada said that on the Janmashtami. He said, if it's too difficult, then take water. He said, if it's still too difficult, then take milk. If it's still too difficult, then take fruit. But he said, you cannot take grains. So at least, you know, basically, if it's too difficult. But we should try to follow the strictest standard that we can. So, Devasa Muni, he became upset. Maharaj Ambarish, he took the water. But the non-devotee, he came back and he was envious. That is the nature of the non-devotee. He's always envious of others. He thinks himself superior to others. So he became envious of Maharaj Ambarish and he cursed him. So he took the hair out of the head, threw it on the ground. The demon came and then it was ready to attack Maharaj Ambarish. But immediately... Sudarshan was invoked. Chakra was invoked. So when Sudarshan came, he immediately destroyed the demon and then he turned on Maharaj Devasa. No, Devasa Muni. Yeah. So he turned on Devasa Muni and Devasa Muni had to flee. So the point that Prabhupada makes, or the point of this section of the Bhagavatam, is that if you commit offenses to devotees, the offenses follow you. You cannot escape the offense, right? You can offend a devotee, but then the offense will continuously follow you wherever you go, and you will have to suffer the reactions of that offense in due course of time. So in due course of time, the offense caught up to him. He had to go all over the universe. He even went to Narayan himself in Vaikuntha. Narayan said, I cannot help you. And the Bhagavatam is teaching us the only way to get forgiveness for our offense. You have to approach the devotee who you have offended. If you approach someone else, it will not work. Yeah? Only the devotee can offend you. Sorry, only the devotee can forgive you. So, he came back to the devotee and he was humbled. So when we are chastised by Krishna or by the devotees or by the guru, it is meant to develop humility within us. Therefore, Chanakya says, the son and the disciple must always be chastised. Because if you do not chastise the son or the disciple, they do not develop good character. They don't become good. You have to tell them. Otherwise, they don't become good. So the child and the disciple must always be chastised. So we see that Devasa was chastised, and then what took place? He became humble. Okay, so what is chapter 5 called?
Devasa Muni's life is spared.
Devasa Muni's life is spared. So he came back to Ambarish Maharaj, and he begged forgiveness from Ambarish Maharaj. He said, please forgive me for my offense. And what did Ambarish Maharaj do? So the nature of a devotee is that he will always forgive. That is the nature of the devotee. Krishna Chakravarti Thakur says that, I mean, a devotee will only not forgive if the offense is very, very serious. But generally, a devotee will forgive. And this offense was very serious. So this shows how exalted Ambarish Maharaj was. Yeah, that he forgave Devasa Muni. So he forgave him. And then, he began to serve Devasa Muni Prasad. So that is Vedic culture. Even when an enemy comes into your home, you treat them like they are a guest. So the enemy came into the home, who just tried to kill him, but he served him so nicely, he thought he was a great friend. And then, actually, Prabhupada points out that for a devotee, everything turns out auspicious in the end. Everything became auspicious, and they became friends. Devasa and Ambarish, everything became pacified, and everyone became satisfied with each other. So if a devotee remains humble, eventually everything will become pacified. Sometimes two devotees are not getting along, but if one of them becomes humble, then everything becomes reconciled. And it should. The point is, in Vedic culture, everything should finish on an auspicious note. In the West, for some reason, and in modern materialistic civilization, things finish on an inauspicious note quite often. Even these days, sometimes you go to the movies, right? You see a movie or something, but then it finishes like the person dies and it's all sad. But in the Vedic, it actually says in the Vedic laws of drama that the drama must finish, any Vedic drama must finish on an auspicious note. There must be like an auspicious, and then it's inauspicious, like when a husband and wife argue, things must finish auspiciously. You can't leave the house like one's angry and the other. It's very inauspicious like that. We see, you know, two devotees, you know, they leave and everything's, you know, you must always finish on an auspicious note. And this requires that one becomes somewhat elevated in consciousness from the modes of nature. So everything became very auspicious, and then Ambarish Maharaj, he went further and further into his bhakti, and he became liberated from this material world. And went back home, back to Godhead. Ambarish Maharaj, Ki. But what is chapter 6 called?
The downfall of Sobari Mandir.
The downfall of Sobari. It's another famous pastime. So basically, Prabhupada points out in the beginning of the chapter, the five things are forbidden in Kali Yuga. We see there's more description of the dynasties as they go on. And we see that Ikshvaku is born from the
sun.
From Manu. Yeah, he comes from Manu. But then how does Ikshvaku appear?
From the nostril.
From the nostril. And then Ikshvaku comes. Like that. So Ikshvaku is born. So, you know, Bhagavad Gita, that's what I mean, this canto. So it's extraordinary, this canto. I think maybe Krishna's just doing all this because we're just about to go to canto 10. So, you know, testing your faith. It's like the men are changing into women, you know, and then the sages get stuck in the eyes and then the kings come out of the nose and it's like all these things. You know, people have to be mentally insane. No, to accept all these things. Non-devotees think, they would think we are mentally insane. To accept all of this. But Krishna is testing our faith. Leading into the 10th canto. In these extraordinary circumstances and situations and descriptions and pastimes. So, it describes that five things are forbidden, because it describes in the beginning of the chapter that one of the brothers had to unite with the wife of his brother in order to keep the dynasty going. But these things are forbidden within the Kali Yuga. One cannot sacrifice the cow, the horse, the cow,
take sannyas,
offer the flesh to the forefathers, and to beget the child and the wife of the brother. These things are not allowed within the age of Kali. Except sannyas is done. But that's, you have to be very, very qualified to be a sannyas in Kali Yuga. It's not easy. So then, we see that in due course of time, Sobari appears. Sobari is in the river, the Jamuna, once again, at Mathura. So once again, he's in the holy Dham. And he is meditating for thousands of years to become perfect. So it's another example. Just like Durvasa was not a devotee, so Sobari was not sufficiently a devotee. Too much involved in the yoga process, as opposed to bhakti. Right? And then Garuda was coming. The story is told Garuda would come and eat the fish. Garuda eats fish and snakes. But he's a pure devotee, a pure Vaishnava. So he would come, he would eat the fish, eat the snakes. But because he was eating the fish in the river Jamuna, and Sobari, they were his friends, because he was living under the water thousands of years. He cursed Garuda, if you come here and take the fish, you will die. So he offended Garuda, because Garuda is a pure devotee. Because of that curse, the mercy of Krishna was withdrawn. He became disturbed in mind when he saw two fish copulating, involved in sex life. He came out onto the bank of the river, went to the king, right, changed his body, eventually into a young man. And then all the princesses, 50 princesses, they wanted to marry him. So then they all fought with each other, and eventually he married all of them, and they had 100 children with each princess. 5,000 kids. Now, what is the lesson here?
Don't go to the bad side.
What is it?
We should not be very careful of offending devotees because you lose your taste for spiritual life.
Yeah, that's one important lesson. Be very careful of Vaishnava. What is it?
Importance of association.
Yeah, importance of association. Yeah, be very careful about committing offenses. Be very careful, and ultimately the Bhagavatam, and we mentioned this in the classes, these two points are extremely important. And this comes up again and again in the ninth canto, and all through the Bhagavatam. The ninth canto is finally mentioning this again and again. Very careful about committing offenses to devotees, because that will ruin your spiritual life, and be very careful of sex desire, because that will also ruin your spiritual life. And if you have sex desire, go through the Grihastha Ashram, because by going through the Grihastha Ashram, you'll become completely detached. Because the nature of Grihastha Ashram is that if you have 50 wives and 100 kids from each wife, then you'll become detached. And in Kali Yuga, you just have to have one wife and two kids, or one kid, and you'll become completely detached. Grihastha Ashram key. Yeah. So sweet. So this is the nature of Grihastha life. It is Krishna's mercy, because it breeds detachment. Sobari had to go through it to that degree. We only have to go through it to a minor degree, and we'll become detached from the material energy, because that's the nature of the material world. It will make you detached if you do it properly. So when you come out of Grihastha Ashram, you will have Vairagya, and you'll be able to surrender to Krishna much more peacefully. Okay.
But so, he had to deliver 50 wives. So they all got spiritually advanced. So if Balaram or Krishna too.
Yep. Very good. And the conclusion of the Bhagavatam is everything is happening because of Krishna.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, another point that Prabhupada points out is that one has to be very careful what one desires, particularly as a devotee. Because if you chant the holy name of Krishna, Nama Chintamani, Krishna's Chaitanya Rasa Vigraha, if you're chanting the holy name but you have material desires, those desires will be fulfilled. So he's there, he's doing all this austerity, and he wants sex life. So Krishna says, okay, have 50 wives. Have 5,000 kids. What's the problem? So you have to be very careful about your material desires, because they will be fulfilled if Krishna desires. Okay, what is chapter 7 called?
The Descendants of King Mandada.
Okay. So then, we see in the beginning of the chapter, there is a disagreement between Vashishtha and Vishwamrita. Right? This is going on, if you read all through the Vedic scriptures, this is a famous quarrel, these two. So what's the basic point that Prabhupada points out? Is that envy always exists in the material world. We see it in every canto. This is like going back in the beginning of the universe. Already everyone was fighting. You go back to the fourth canto, Daksha Yagya, everyone was fighting. You know, Daksha was proud. I mean, it's there from the beginning. Because what is the nature of the material world is that everyone is envious, everyone is proud. All bad qualities exist in the material world. So even very exalted people, they perform very negative activities. It's the nature of the material world, it's full of envy. And then chapter 8, what is chapter 8 called?
The sons of Sagar made Lord Kapiladev.
Yeah, sons of Sagar. So we covered that whole chapter last time. Not many purports in chapters 7 and 8. So in chapter 8, the sons of Sagar, they go towards Kapila. And Kapila, as Prabhupada points out, he is on the platform of Shuddha Sattva, or pure devotional service. So being on the platform of Shuddha Sattva, or pure devotional service, he has no envy in his heart. And when the boys come, they think that he is Indra, and he has stolen the horse, which is meant for the sacrificial Ashwamedha Jagar of their father. They come to kill Kapiladev. And Kapila, being a pure devotee, just because they're envious towards him, that envy burns them up, that sinful, offensive mentality, it burns them up, and they all, their bodies turn to ashes. And the Bhagavatam says that some people think that Kapila, he burnt them to ashes by his glance. He saw them all coming towards him angrily, and then he burnt them. But it says that he did not even look. The Bhagavatam clearly says that just if you offend a devotee, you will get the reaction from Krishna. So once again, the Bhagavatam is teaching us, be very careful how you deal with the devotees, because you will get reactions. So, any other points?
Again, it was like Krishna is doing.
Oh my God.
he made this in that way.
Acha.
He sent the intelligence.
Acha. Any other points? Okay. So the exam will be next Monday, like that, at 7 o'clock. Please come. Srila Prabhupada ki
jai.
Om.